Well, now it's time to turn to Europe and what is happening there. How to choose out of an enormous smorgasbord of things that really are happening that we'd be interested in. Well, actually, we give some of that choice to Brendan O'Neill, our regular contributor, and he joins us now. Brendan, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Amanda.
Let's talk about Jihadi John. What is this story that his mum knew straight away it was him just by looking at his eyes?
Yes, that's the story. Jihadi John has now been revealed as Mohammed Enwazi, who is a 26-year-old Kuwaiti-born Londoner who went to university in London, went to school in London, has a London accent, obviously. And the story is that as soon as his mother saw the videos a few months back, she recognised him from his eyes and also from his voice. And it's a very sad story for the family. But it's been a devastating story for Britain as well, because we have spent the past week since his identity was confirmed asking ourselves, torturing ourselves over the question of how this guy who was brought up in Britain, whose family benefited from the education system, from the welfare state, from all the niceness of living in London, how he could have ended up thousands of miles away in a war zone decapitating Westerners. And that question has really burnt into people's minds. And not many of the answers are very convincing, in my view. There's a lot of blame game going on in relation to this. People trying to blame MI5 for having harassed him, or the political system in Britain for ignoring Muslims. I think it's been a shallow discussion of what might have propelled this young Londoner to go to Syria and become a mass murderer.
Mm. How long ago was it that that video appeared on YouTube and went around the world of Jihadi John?
It was last year the video appeared, the first one.
Mm. Now, have you read, as I have, that there are other people in similar circumstances who've been approached pretty early in their teen years to join up in an anti-Western propaganda? People going to university, for example? That he's not a loner at all. I mean, he might be a loner in the way he conducts himself, but he is not the only one that's been approached and groomed.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I would not use the word groomed, because I think it makes it sound like they were brainwashed and that their role was very passive. You know, we've also heard that they've been radicalized, as if radicalization is some kind of disease that washes over people. And I think we undermine the individual's own autonomy and their own choices. Because, you know, my view is that Mohammed Enwazi made a choice to go to Syria. He made a choice to stab that person or kill that person. These are things that he chose to do. And I think too much of the debate has tried to deny his own responsibility. So we say that Muslims aren't treated particularly well in Britain, or they are harassed by the security services, or they feel that there is too much Islamophobia. Now, all those things might be true. I think they're exaggerated, but there is some truth to them. But nonetheless, people still choose to take a path in life. And there's been just a bit too much hand-wringing for my liking in the discussion about Jihadi John. Too much saying, oh, Britain is to blame. It's our fault. We brought it on ourselves by not treating our minorities in a decent way. And I don't like that kind of self-flagellation. I think we have to accept that individuals make decisions, immoral decisions, and they should be held responsible for them.
Mm. Did you read the piece in the New York Times called The Education of Jihadi John in the Opinion Pages by Majid Nawaz?
Yes, I did. I think there is something to be discussed in relation to British universities and the way in which lots of young Muslims do become radical. I think they contribute to their own radicalization. They often become radical at universities. And I think the problem is that universities in Britain are becoming quite soft, and they aren't asserting the superiority of Enlightenment knowledge, Western knowledge, the very things that universities are supposed to promote. They've become much more reluctant to do that. And as a consequence, on campuses across Britain, there is the emergence of another way of thinking among certain students, particularly young Muslim students. And I have seen it myself. I've done speeches at universities in London at which there are radical Muslims who say quite shocking things and quite anti-Western things. But my view is that we need to challenge them. We need to confront them. We need to tell them when they're talking rubbish. We need to tell them that, you know, there are other books and other texts that are superior to the kind of things that they say and the kind of things that they promote. But there is a reluctance in universities in Britain at the moment to have that kind of intellectual confrontation. And as a consequence, lots of radical Muslims carry on promoting their rubbish. So I do think there is an issue with universities and how they've become a breeding ground for some of that backward thinking.
Yeah. Is that because they're just, as so many people are, sadly now, reluctant to offend people? I don't mean by that it's a good thing to offend people, but it is a good thing to say what you think and not keep your thoughts locked away simply because someone else might not like them. Is it that reluctance to cause offence amongst the student movement? Or is it something equally as bad, perhaps worse, and that is universities taking on a valueless position? We have no values. You as students can go and find the values. That's what you're here for. We're not here to discriminate and propose one thing or another. You, the student body, are there to find your sets of values. And that, I think, is a mistake, serious mistake, because, as you rightly say, Western culture has a lot to offer, and we should be promoting that, not only to Islamists, incidentally. I don't think we do it enough to our own young students.
I think that's exactly right. I think actually it's a combination of those two things. I think there's a real climate of relativism in too many universities at the moment, where there's an unwillingness to say that one idea is better than another, or one historical philosopher is better than, you know, a modern philosopher who doesn't say anything of any particular value. There is a real climate of relativism, a shamefacedness about the Western tradition, the Western canon, the Enlightenment. And I think students pick up on that. They recognize there's a defensiveness. And at the same time, there is, exactly as you say, an unwillingness to give offense, kind of tiptoeing around identities. You can really see that in the rise of the term Islamophobia, because in Britain, particularly on campuses, Islamophobia no longer just refers to actual prejudice or violence against Muslims. It also refers to criticism of Islam and criticism of the Muslim veil, for example, or criticism of certain Islamist ideas. Even challenging people's ideas and beliefs, which I think is an entirely legitimate thing to do, is now referred to as Islamophobia. So students get the impression that traditional Western ideas aren't all that great, and any criticism of their way of life is phobic and racist and wrong. And I think when we give them that impression, we allow them to run with their own kind of ideas, which are not particularly positive a lot of the time.
I mean, just to pick one church, for example, the Roman Catholic Church, they'd love to have a position where no one criticised what they thought, their beliefs and some of the things they still practice now. I mean, they just think that was a terrific world where no one dare criticise because it might cause offence.
Exactly.
It's just a joke, isn't it?
A lot of universities have been turned into safe spaces, which means...
Yeah, we've discussed that, haven't we?
Yeah, in those spaces you're not allowed to criticise, you're not allowed to raise alternative ideas, and we make students feel like they should never be pushed or challenged or questioned.
Or
that's
shocked.
Exactly what should happen to students.
Exactly, I know. Look, I couldn't agree more. Safe space at universities is meant to be the place where really dangerous ideas do get an airing.
Exactly.
Anyway, look, we've talked about people not liking being offended, so let's move on to the next issue, which is prominent in Europe at the moment, and that's hate speech laws. Mm. Have the French gone too far, do you think?
I think the French have gone too far. I think their response to the massacre at Charlie Hebdo in January has been quite shocking, actually, because initially the response was quite positive. Pretty much everyone in France, including French politicians, said, "Je suis Charlie, you know, we are going to stand by these cartoonists, we're going to stand by this magazine." But in fact, what's happened over the past 2 months is that 54 people were arrested in the week after the attack for various forms of hate speech. Three people have been convicted of anti-gay hate speech on Twitter and have been fined around €1,000 each, I think. And now the Justice Minister of France wants to introduce a new law which would allow the French state to unilaterally shut down websites that they judge to be hateful or to be breaking hate speech laws. And I just think it's really bad to respond to an attack on free speech by instituting new attacks on free speech. And I'm worried about the way in which Europe itself, not just Islamists or gunmen or intolerant groups of people, but Europe itself is now incapable of defending freedom of speech.
We are nonetheless still looking at a problem where we have commentators saying, look, the effect of criticising a minority is much more serious than the effect of criticising the majority, because the minority already feel disempowered, and that really arguing the case that it is okay to say we have to watch in a legal sense what we say about minorities, putting aside how we should all obviously say what you can as courteously as possible and not deliberately cause offence. But there are still people out there arguing this case that, you know, the Muslim community needs to be looked after because they are the minority and they feel picked on.
Yeah, and I think that's really worrying, because what they are basically arguing is that minority groups in society don't benefit from freedom of speech, and in fact they benefit from censorship, and they should be surrounded by a censorious force field protecting them from ridicule or hatred or whatever else. And that's a really bad message to send, because freedom of speech is the most useful tool that people who are alienated or isolated or disempowered, it's the most useful tool those people could have, because it allows them to express themselves, to organize, to be politically organized, to publish their ideas. You know, I always think of Frederick Douglass, the great American slave who escaped and became a social reformer. He wrote a wonderful essay in the 1800s, A Plea for Free Speech. And he said slavery wouldn't have lasted 5 years if blacks had had freedom of speech. And he said it's the most important tool for those who want to liberate themselves. So I'm worried at the way in which often quite well-meaning commentators and politicians give the very clear impression that freedom of speech only benefits mainstream white men. That's usually what they say. And it's not useful to minorities and women and homosexuals and so on. I think that's really wrong. It's the best thing that those kind of groups have, and it's what they need.
Hmm. What about the notion that all the world's Muslims are asked to, I think someone described it as, collectively carry the weight of ISIS guilt? Is there an element of truth in the fact that, or in the suggestion, that a lot of people treat all Muslims as being the same, all Islamists as being the same, and don't differentiate between what I call a moderate Muslim and a radical Muslim?
There are people like that, there's no question, and there are new growing movements in parts of Europe, including in Britain and Germany and Belgium, which are basically anti-Islam movements, and they are demanding less immigration from Muslim countries. Some of them are demanding that Muslims should be sent back to the countries they come from, even though huge numbers of Muslims are actually born in Europe. So there is anti-Muslim bigotry, there's no question about that. I do think sometimes the impact of it tends to be exaggerated, but more concerning for me is the way in which this very real problem of anti-Muslim bigotry gets mixed together with what we were just talking about, which is the idea of Islamophobia and the idea that it's wrong to criticize any aspect of Islam. And I don't want to see a situation in Europe where a genuine and correct concern with any form of violence or discrimination against Muslims, which is wrong and should be punished, gets mixed together with any kind of intellectual criticism of Muslims or cultural depiction of Muslims in a less than flattering light, or, you know, ridicule of Muhammad. All those kind of things, I think, are legitimate in a system in which there is freedom of speech. We must have the freedom to blaspheme, to criticize ways of life, to criticize ideas. And I'm worried that the concern with prejudice against Muslims is tripping over into a clampdown on what we're allowed to say about what is, at the end of the day, a religion that we should all be allowed to criticise.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's move from there to Russia and the killing of Nemtsov. This is not good news, is it?
It's not good news, and it does look quite shady, particularly to outside eyes. Boris Nemtsov was Deputy Prime Minister under Yeltsin in the 90s. He was a very vocal critic of Putin over the past 10 years. At the time of his death, he was doing two quite important things. He was planning a rally in Moscow against the Russian warmongering in the Ukraine, and he was also working on a report which would apparently reveal that Russia is indeed supporting rebels in eastern Ukraine. So the fact that he was killed does look very suspicious, and there are lots of questions that need to be answered.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned he was working on a report. Didn't he go as far as saying the report would show that Russia was in fact involved?
Yes, he did say that. And I think most people now accept that Russia is involved at some level. So,
yeah,
and
be hard
I think
not
his,
to.
Yeah, and I think his report would probably have confirmed that with some facts and material. But I think even as we look at this and ask ourselves, what is going on there? What's this all about? I do think at the same time there is a danger of pushing everything that happens in Russia into this kind of black and white morality tale where, you know, there was this instant knee-jerk reaction across the European media that Putin must have ordered this killing or Putin must have created the climate in which such a killing could have taken place. You know, Obama and Merkel and various European politicians instantly said, you know, Putin must investigate this, must prove that he had nothing to do with it. And I'm just worried about the way in which there's this instant desire to recreate a kind of Cold War mentality in Europe and to say, well, we over here are good, but over there it's still an evil empire. It's still a crazy country. It still does things very differently to us. And I'm not sure that that kind of divisiveness is really useful to Europe in the 21st century.
But would it not be difficult to say, look, they're a great bunch, they're just like us?
No.
To take the reverse? I mean, it's not that easy to make that case, is it?
No, I certainly don't think Putin is great. I think he's authoritarian, he's a liberal, he's a populist. But at the same time, as well as being a populist, he's also popular. And I think one of the dangerous consequences of this kind of recreation, this kind of restaging of the Cold War, is that actually Putin starts to posture against the West and starts to define himself in opposition to the West. So he's quite self-consciously, for example, he's very suspicious of gay rights because he recognizes that Western politicians use that against him. And so he fires back at them by saying, well, we don't like homosexuals in Russia. So this is one of the crazy consequences of this kind of drama that's playing out in Europe, which is Putin responds in the way in which you would expect him to, which is by becoming more conservative, more traditionalist, and more authoritarian. And it's this dangerous playing off of two value systems. And I think both sides lose out as a consequence.
Well, there's an even less attractive, I think, scenario been suggested by some, and that is that his own people had him killed so that they could have a martyr to, in fact, strengthen the anti-Putin forces. They decided the best thing was to have him as a martyr and therefore had him killed. I mean, I find that difficult to accept that people think like that, but history tells us that some people do. What do you think of that proposition?
I think, again, it's a proposition which sounds very shocking, but again, there are questions that need to be answered and we need to work out exactly who did it. But that is a possibility. And I think if something like that did happen, that, again, I think, would speak to the way in which the West is now playing with Russia in a bit of a dangerous way. And it's cultivating these movements in Russia. It funds a lot of pro-democracy NGOs, for example, which gets Putin's backs up. And he has passed lots of laws recently to ban the foreign funding of NGOs. So the West is always looking for groups in Russia that it can cultivate, that it can work with, sometimes quite surreptitiously, that it can celebrate. So if there are movements in Russia that now think they need a martyr or they need to do something that will bump up the sympathy of Western observers, I think that too, if that were the case, that too could be a consequence of the slightly dangerous game that Western Europe is playing with Russia at the moment.
Well, it's a dangerous world we live in, Brendan. It's a good job that you and I have got some common sense and most of our listeners have as well.
Exactly.
Just a bit of a worry that those running the world don't always appear to have it. Never mind, Brendan, thanks very much for joining us again and taking us on a quick trip around just some of the problems facing Europe today.
Thanks, Amanda.
Brendan O'Neill is the editor of Spiked in London, and he'll be back next month with more from Europe. You're on RN, and you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone.